It's not often in my travels that I get to talk to a fellow playwright. For some reason, we just never get invited to the same meetings, let alone a comic playwright, let alone arguably one of the greatest living comic playwrights of our generation. Here to possibly argue with me about that description is Ken Ludwig, the author of Oh My Gosh, Lend Me a Tenor, A Moon Over Buffalo, the Gershwin musical Crazy for You, and many others that I'm forgetting. Am I right? It's fair to say call you the greatest comic playwright of our generation, isn't it?
I think perfectly fair. Indeed, you could have said of the 20th and 21st century, and I think it would be a little more accurate, but that's okay.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or tablet or phone. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, number 500, playwright Ken Ludwig. Oh my goodness, episode 500. For 500 weeks, since the first week of December in 2006, I've been producing this regular backstage audio blog of what the Reduced Shakespeare Company's been up to, what I've been up to, and what our company members are up to. And along the way, I've been able to talk to some amazing artists and authors and comedians and directors and playwrights who've graciously given of their time to share their methods and insights with me. I wanted to do something special for this 500th episode, and talking to Ken Ludwig is about as special as it gets. Not only is he the author of almost 24 plays and musicals, 6 of which have played on Broadway and 7 in the West End, not only have he and his plays won multiple Tony Awards, Olivier Awards, Helen Hayes Awards, and even the Edgar Award from the Mystery Writers of America, not only all that stuff, I also worked as an assistant on the world premiere production of Ken's play Opera Bouffe at the American Stage Festival in New Hampshire, which was then produced by Andrew Lloyd Webber in London and retitled Lend Me a Tenor. So to be reunited with Ken recently in Washington, D.C. was a huge thrill, and he began our conversation by reminiscing about our time together in New Hampshire.
And the remarkable thing is, I remember, as you were probably, what, in your 30s or 40s, and I was like 12, 13. I was this remarkable prodigy, if you'll recall.
I do recall. I was wondering where the cutoff point for being a wunderkind was.
Yeah, but that was it. That was it.
But you are also a lawyer, right? Am I right about that?
You're not right and not right, because people do describe me as a lawyer, and I usually strangle them, because I'm not, after college, I applied to some law schools because it was sort of the done thing in my family circle, and my brother had done that, and I got into Harvard Law School. So I went to Harvard Law School, and because I had no money. And while I was in the middle of Harvard Law School, I got a scholarship to Cambridge University. I studied at Trinity College, Cambridge, for a couple years. Mm-hmm. Then I came back, finished Harvard Law School, and at the end of Harvard Law School, I had to do something to make a living because I'd written some plays quietly during college, but they weren't making any money yet. And so I practiced law for two, three, four years, and then came along Lend Me a Tenor, and then came along Andrew Lloyd Webber, and it was produced, and it won all the Olivier's and the Tony's, and I got out of the law. So I don't practice law. And one of the things that drives me crazy is when, say, for interviews,
The idiot podcaster asks you.
The idiot podcaster. The old friend, the great old friend who I love seeing, who is an idiot podcaster, will say, oh, you're a lawyer, aren't you? You just do theater on the side.
Annoying. Well, and this was leading to the question, when did you become a playwright? But it sounds like you were a playwright for a very long time, before you were anything else.
Well, when I was growing up, my parents took me to a couple plays, and I said, this is for me. I love the theater. I really fell in love with it. I mean, very early. It's all I wanted to do. Yeah. Then when I was in my early teens, my parents had seen, you know, years and years before the famous Richard Burton Hamlet, and they bought me the LPs, and I played them, and I became a big Shakespeare guy. I loved Shakespeare. Then I loved theater. I did it in high school. school. I did it in college. And I knew all I wanted to do was be in the theater. But, as I say, because the family said, gee, you can't make a living in the theater, you better do something. So I applied to law schools and got in and then practiced for a little while, all the while knowing all I wanted to do was be a playwright.
Not an actor, not a director.
Well, it started out as an actor when I was in high school, because, you know, you think that's what being in the theater is. You know, that's all you see. So you think, oh, you don't even know there's a director back there or a designer. And you start getting more sophisticated in the middle of your high school years, and then college you do. So when I was a little kid actor, I was in all the shows. I was, incidentally, you'll be interested in this, I played Henry Higgins in My Fair Lady in high school, in my senior year of high school. And it was said that I was the greatest Henry Higgins since Rex Harrison. It was said by my mother, but it was said.
Similarly, I was the definitive senior in high school, Harold Hill.
Aha!
We have graduated to great things. Is it fair to say that your comedies are all of a genre? I'm not even asking that correctly. Like, for instance, Let Me a Tenor is out and out farce. Sullivan Gilbert, which I also had the privilege of working on as assistant, is, I guess, a backstage musical. There is some sort of conceit to the plays. Am I right about that, or am I just overgeneralizing?
No, I think you're right. A lot of my plays, I usually don't use the word farce. I kind of like muscular comedy or romantic comedy, because farce, I think, denotes for a lot of people, silliness.
Yes.
And I don't think of them that way. Farce always denotes for me a kind of silliness that my plays in my heart don't have. What they have is romance. They have character. They have, you know, a storyline that I care deeply about. They say things I want deeply about. As I like to say, when I sit down to write, I'm always trying to write Twelfth Night. It comes out as Moon Over Buffalo and Crazy for You and Leading Ladies and Fox and the Fairway and The Games Afoot and Baskerville. And so I've written 23 plays and musicals at this point. I've had 6 on Broadway, and I've had 7 on the West End. I'm just about to have a new show, I think, on the West End, and I think a new show on Broadway this year. I'm very hopeful. I think this is going to be a big year. But all my plays are of a piece in the sense that I think they have a real sense of romance to them, and romance about the theater, and a romantic heart in the sense of a heart of hopefulness, a real comic engine in the best sense of the word. As I was saying to you earlier, it seems to me that comedy is not just a matter of happy endings. Comedy is a matter of creating an environment where happy endings are inevitable. Right. To create a world of beauty and romance and comedy.
Yeah. Well, and you talked about an engine that drives it. I mean, I think I would call that engine passion. That the characters, I mean, starting from the playwright who's written with passion, but also the characters have a passion and desires and that are as urgent as anything you would see in a high drama or in a tragedy, and yet it's for something as quote unquote lightweight as love, you know. But that doesn't make it any less real or powerful. And for me, that, for want of a better word, darkness behind all the comedy is what makes the comedy richer, I think.
I couldn't agree with you more. Absolutely. Absolutely. Look, Romeo and Juliet is sort of a comedy in the first 3 acts till Tybalt and Mercutio die, in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, having a passion, a real deep passion, and love is often that engine for both tragedies and comedy. So having a deep sense of romance is at the heart of comedy. It's really your attitude towards how the world works and whether you can make things better in the world, and whether to have hope as opposed to death and catharsis. You know, when in Macbeth they use the term the bloody point, the action moves to the bloody point. It ends with a bang. Yeah. Tragedies tend to end with a big bang. Stephen Greenblatt was talking about that at the Folger the other day.
I heard it.
Did you? Yeah. And, you know, comedies don't. Comedies, you think of what's going to happen after the curtain falls, because there's a sense of continuity and life that goes on.
Yeah.
And that's the difference.
Yeah, that is interesting. That's very true. And sometimes, yeah, what some shows have been written about the fact that what happens after the happily ever after isn't very happy.
Right.
But that can be another comedy in and of itself.
Absolutely.
Well, and you said, and you're also talking about you're creating a world in which comedy is inevitable, and a world in love with love, but in love with the theater. All your plays are theatrical. I mean, they might look like they have, some of them have realistic sets, like a realistic pair of hotel rooms in Lend Me a Tenor. But they're overtly theatrical spaces.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. Very smart. They're in two different ways. One way is that often my plays are set in the world of theater specifically. Lend Me a Tenor, backstage at the opera. It happens to be in a hotel room, but it's backstage at the opera.
Your Marx Brothers comedy?
Sort of. I guess it is. Moon Over Buffalo is in a green room of a theater in Leading Ladies. They put on 12th Night. So yes, they all, virtually all, deeply are about the theater per se. Some of them, like Baskerville, a play I wrote recently, which is a 5-person retelling of The Hound of the Baskervilles, is meant to be theatrical in its telling of the story, in a really overt way of being theatrical. So you've got me right, exactly.
And it's five people, I'm sure, playing many, many, many parts.
Yeah, it's yes, exactly. There's a Holmes, there's a Watson, they don't change, and three other actors play 40 parts.
That's awesome. Can you talk a little bit about your relationship to directors? Because the playwright-director relationship is one I've pontificated about on the podcast before, and it's really one I'm ignorant of, because I haven't found that director with whom I have been able to be a creative partner. I mean, aside from Reed Martin, and he and I write and direct each other. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's hard to find a director who you're really simpatico with. I've been very lucky. I've had some really wonderful directors, starting with Jerry Zaks, who did Lend Me a Tenor on Broadway, and before that, David Gilmour, who did Lend Me a Tenor in London, who's a genius. I just had lunch with him a month ago in London at the Garrick Club, I might add.
Of course. Why wouldn't you?
And... But I think you have to be open to... It's hard as a playwright. You've got to be open to new ideas. You've got to say, all right, I do want somebody to contribute to this. I've written some of my... I've directed some of my own plays. I directed the world premiere of Leading Ladies at the Alley. That was my first directing gig, was for this, 800-seat theater that was playing for 2 months, and then it transferred to Cleveland, and so I started with a lot on my hands.
Yeah.
And I loved it. But what I love about having a director, a professional director, is somebody who can read the play, go through the first scene, rehearsal, and then say, Ken, those two pages, you can do better than those two pages.
Oh, wow.
That's hard for me to see myself.
Yeah.
So it's good to have that other eye out there. Right. So I just finished a new play today, as I mentioned earlier, and I'm thinking of directing that one. But I then go back and say, maybe I want that other eye giving me some good advice.
Right.
But in terms of to answer your question, working with a director, you got to keep your mind open. Yeah. And also, I have to find directors who are willing to have me be an interfering busybody and drive them crazy.
Yeah.
Because I can't sit in a rehearsal room and see something going in the wrong direction and not speak up.
Right. Right.
Well, that's the trick. Is a playwright can't be just grateful for a director's interest. It's got to be the right director who wants to work with you in the way you want to be worked with.
And it's a creative two-way street.
Yeah.
You've both got to be interchanging ideas all the time and really have a director who doesn't feel threatened by that. I understand it. When you're in the rehearsal room and doing that, that's the director's domain. But you have to have a director who's good enough and self-confident enough to say, oh, great, Ken, the more you tell me, the better, because I want to understand the play and I want to make it the best version of this play I can.
Yeah.
You need that. I need that director.
And so then how hard is it to find actors for your pieces? Do you find that there's that you require a certain kind of an actor?
Yeah, I need actors who are flexible and open to changes. Look, when I go into rehearsal for a new play, you don't know. A play is a blueprint. A play isn't really a finished article like a novel is. It's kind of like a skeleton in a way, no matter how far you think you've taken it. So by the time you get to the first rehearsal, you have to look at it with a pencil in your hand, your sleeves rolled up, and figure, I'm going to change 30% of this, 40% of this, right, in the course of rehearsals. So you need actors who are willing to take that journey with you. Yeah. When I did Baskerville, opened at an arena stage in the MacArthur Theater, Princeton, as a co-production, I rewrote the entire second act after the first preview that night until 6 a.m.
Oh, my God.
The first act were gangbusters, and I could see the second act just wasn't giving people what they wanted. And I saw what it was, and I went back and rewrote it.
Wow. And that's the kind of thing you can't see until it gets in front of an audience, which is where all the new work begins.
They tell you everything. An audience tells you everything in the theater, and you can't deny it. It's no good saying, oh, but that should work. After the third try, you're finished.
Right. Well, and I often find, Reed and I talk about this all the time. It's you know, with a comedy, it's binary. They either laugh or they don't.
Right.
You know?
That's absolutely right.
You know, and in a drama, they're sitting there quietly. Oh, they must be loving it and engrossed. No, they don't. Just sitting there quietly.
Right. They're so impressed with how smart I am. Their just mouths are agape. That's right. Why I don't hear a sound. You can't do that with comedy.
No, you really, really can't.
As far as I know, I'm Weird Al Yankovic.
You're listening to Tim Minchin.
Hi, this is Cory Booker.
Hi, this is Octavia Solis.
Hi, I'm Ann Hage.
Hi, I'm Scott Simon of NPR News.
Hey, I'm Eric Stonestreet from ABC's Modern Family.
Hi, this is Scott Bakula.
Hi, I'm Kate Kitchener. I'm Austin's mother.
Hey, this is Joel Murray, Freddie Rumsen from Mad Men.
Hi, this is Cynthia Ryder, Executive Director of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival.
I'm Michael Whitmore, Director of the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C.
Hello, my name is Nicholas Parsons.
Hi, I'm Rachel Dratt.
This is Christopher Moore.
Hi, I'm Ken Ludwig.
Hey, I'm Reed Diamond.
I'm Peter Holland. I'm the McNeil Family Professor in Shakespeare Studies at the University of Notre Dame.
This is David Koechner.
Hello, folks. This is Mike McShane.
Hello, I'm Adrian Scarborough.
Hi, I'm Matt Walsh of the Upright Citizens Brigade.
Hi, I'm Brian Dennehy, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Quality of mercy is not strained. It's sprinkled from above like the... No.
Where can you RSE the RSE? Next month, from August 3rd to the 29th, we'll be performing the European premiere, or maybe it's now just the British premiere. God, maybe it's going to only be the Scottish premiere. Anyway, we'll be performing for the first time outside the United States William Shakespeare's long-lost first play, Abridged, at the Pleasance Courtyard at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. That's for the entire month of August. Then this fall of 2016, we'll be all over the U.S. performing our special election edition of The Complete History of America, Abridged. Those dates are up on our website now. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReduceShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office venue and ticket information. And now back to my conversation with playwright Ken Ludwig. So 23 plays since I knew you 31 years ago, but so that's prolific. I mean, as far as that's almost a play a year-ish kind of.
Yeah, it is, exactly.
Yeah, that's great. How long does it take you to write a play? About a year?
I figure that I can come up with one new project a year, though the past 5 or 6 years I've been pretty prolific, and I've been actually done more than 23, because I've also done some children's plays, and I wrote this book, but I work all the time. I mean, I saw a wonderful thing in today's Guardian review, that wonderful sort of book review that comes out of England, from the Guardian publishes once a week, and it was an interview with Hilary Mantel, and she was saying, you know, people who come up to me and say, are you working on anything? And she says, you know, I'm not a hobbyist. This is not a hobby. I'm a professional writer, and I write every day, and I write about 8 to 10 hours a day, and I work very, very hard at what I do. I love it. I love it, just love it to death. Yeah. But I work very, very hard.
Well, and I assume that when you're writing the one thing, you probably somewhere in the back of your brain, you're thinking about the next couple of things.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Often started them, often started sketching them out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It makes for a nice break from the one thing. If you can just go, I'm up against the wall, you know what? I'm just going to go take some notes on the other thing.
Absolutely. And sometimes you have to come back to them. I have a new play. I can talk about it now. I have a new play. It's going to open at McCarter. We'd love it to go on, but, you know, you never know what's going to happen with these. The Agatha Christie Estate came to me and asked me if I would take one of her novels and put it on stage.
Oh.
So I chose Murder on the Orient Express. And I've written it, and the estate is great with it, and we're going to open. It opens next season at the McCarter, and it's all set. We have our director. We have our designers. William Ivy Long's doing the costumes,
oh, wow,
and Beowulf Port is doing the set, and it's great.
Right.
So I'm very excited about it. Emily Mann's directing. Who, you know, runs the McCarter Theater. She's a doll. She's so great. She's a great, great friend. She's wonderful. We did a reading about 2 months ago. The reading was gangbusters, had wonderful people in it. But as we went through, I thought, first act's a little long. It just felt like 7 minutes, 8 minutes too long. Ooh, should I do that doubling or not? The doubling is kind of fun. It makes it a lot of, or is it confusing in the context of a mystery? So I put it aside for the past 2 months, finished this new play that I just finished called The Gods of Comedy. And now, 2 months later, I'll go back to Murder on the Orient Express with a sort of a fresh mind and go, what did I learn? Mm-hmm. Because these things are all a progress.
Yeah. Well, yes, and one thing informs the other.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, God, well, it would be fun to just go down the list of 23 and tell me stories, but that'll be another podcast.
Good. I'd love to.
Let's talk about the book. Your book is How to Teach Your Children Shakespeare. Which seems, again, like such a great idea. Why has nobody written this before? Where did that come from for you?
Well, it came out of a personal experience. My daughter came home from first grade. She was 6 years old and said, "Daddy, I know a bank where the wild thyme blows." I jumped back. Jack, where did this come from? Well, her teacher had taught them a line of Shakespeare. In fact, two. Also, the second line. I know a bank where the wild thyme blows, where ox slips and the nodding violet grows. And I thought, oh, geez, Louise, my daughter knows some Shakespeare, and I love Shakespeare. I'm a real Shakespeare nerd. And so I sat down with her, and every Sunday and every Saturday and every Sunday, an hour each, we would sit and learn passages from Shakespeare, and I'd have her memorize them one after another, and she learned suddenly it was five passages from Midsummer Night's Dream. I started with Midsummer because it's best for kids. The opening, of course, is always great. Now, fair Hippolyta, our nuptial hour draws on apace. They learn words, the word nuptial. They learn apace, you know, so now, fair Hippolyta, now beautiful woman who I'm going to marry. Our wedding plans are coming, our wedding will come along soon, draws on apace. So she just absorbed it like all kids do. And so I did that. She's now off to college, and I did it with my son. And I was sitting around one day, and I thought, gee, I wonder if I could write this method out, talk to people about how they could do this with their kids, because it's so much fun to do with your kids. You snuggle up in bed together when they're little. It's a real good family time. It makes them smarter. It makes them more literate. They're introduced to Shakespeare. Yeah. So when my daughter went off to college, she knew 1,000 lines of Shakespeare. Now, the guilty secret about the book is that most adults are afraid of Shakespeare, too. You know, it's like a foreign language. What I liken it to is it's a foreign language. It would be like going to see a play in Italian.
Yeah.
You go, I can sort of follow the action, but I don't understand a lot of the words.
Right.
Well, by following this simple book, and you will also get steak knives if you order this book by tonight at midnight. But by doing what's in this book, you really do learn. The way I did it was, the method in the book is exactly what I did with my kids, which was take simple passages when they're young, and the passages get more and more complex as they get older, and they memorize them. They learn every word first of what each thing means. I know a bank where the wild thyme blows. Well, what is a bank? Well, we all, most of us know that's the two sides of a little river bed or a stream bed. I know a bank where the wild thyme blows. What is thyme? Well, thyme is a flower. It's an aromatic flower. It's an herb, but it's also a very beautiful flower. Then again, Shakespeare being Shakespeare, maybe he's playing with the idea of time, T-I-M-E. Mm-hmm. I know a bank where the wild thyme blows. Well, blows, it could mean blowing in the wind, but it actually, in Elizabethan times, didn't mean that. It had a specific Elizabethan meaning, which meant blossom into flower. So it means, I know a bank where the wild thyme flower blows and is blossoming into flower. Yeah. And once your child knows that, hears that, they love it. They identify with it. They get interested. And if you just stay about a page ahead of your kid in this book, you read the book and go, oh, if I stay two pages ahead or one or two pages ahead, I teach my kid Shakespeare and I learn it myself.
Yeah. Well, and you teach your kids and yourself to investigate language on more than just the surface level. You know, right. There are all these other branches sticking out of these words that you get, and you can follow any one of them.
And that's what poetry is.
Yeah.
Poetry is a question, and I have a whole chapter in what is poetry as opposed to prose. So I try to do it at a nice, simple level. I tell Shakespeare's life. I talk about what is poetry. I talk about what is a comic play and what is a tragic play. You and I were talking about, you know, a comic play is also, for Shakespeare, having something in it that is non-realistic. You know, twins that are so identical, you mix them up. Gods coming down from the heavens. What is comedy? Who published Shakespeare's plays and is the greatest heroes of, as much as Shakespeare? Well, two of his fellow members of his company named Hemings and Condell in 1623, Shakespeare died in 1616. In 1623, they came out with the first folio, and we have 18 of the plays that we wouldn't otherwise have, thanks to the first folio. They're great heroes.
Yeah.
So I do short, informative chapters about the history of all this, and then teach them what poetry means, that poetry is a question of levels.
Yeah. And Shakespeare is just a great baseline, you know, to learn about so many things and from which so many other writers have drawn inspiration.
Oh, boy, are you right. That is exactly the point. You know, you do this, you really work on Shakespeare. The reason why I do it is sort of maybe three or four different reasons or 10 different reasons, but certainly one is for the beauty of itself. In itself, it opens you up and makes you smarter, makes you more moral, teaches you lessons, teaches you how to face life problems and just, you know, that you might not otherwise anticipate, so it's great for growing up. Secondly is what you just said, that every author since Shakespeare depends so deeply on Shakespeare for the meaning. They all knew them. Right. Jane Austen knew her Shakespeare backwards and forwards. Jane Austen Society of North America is having its annual convention here in Washington in October, and they asked me if I would give one of the big speeches. I'm doing the opening speech at the convention.
Oh, cool.
It's an anniversary about Emma. And in looking at this, I've realized more and more how much Jane Austen knew her Shakespeare, loved her Shakespeare, imitated her Shakespeare, as did Dickens, look at Mark Twain, Huckleberry Finn, our greatest novel in American history, has a whole riff on Shakespeare, because two of the characters pretend to be Shakespearean actors, and they do that riff on To Be or Not to Be, which is so hilarious.
Yeah.
Shakespeare is so deeply part of our literary heritage. He is the bedrock of Western civilization, along with the King James Bible.
Right.
You've got to know your Shakespeare. If you want to be a really literate person and a civilized person in our world.
Well, and this is bringing me back to your own theatrical comedies too, is that your plays all seem to be inspired by literature or the theater or the opera. I mean, specifically, I mean, you set it in those worlds. I guess you're not shy. That's a conscious thing for you.
It's very conscious. It's very smart of you to notice that. I love the opera.
Yeah.
I love Shakespeare so deeply, and I love all of literature. I read. And that's always my advice to somebody if they want to be a writer, is read. There are three secrets. It's read, read, and read. Literature is passed on like a torch race, and you learn from the people who came before you, and you grow on that, you make it richer and deeper, and that's part of what is being, that's part of being in the literary world,
right,
and mining those great joys and discoveries, and the richness of the past is part of being a writer, and I take that real seriously.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Send us the play you set out to write every time via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also engage with us and other fans on Facebook or Twitter. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Thanks, as always, to webmaster Matt Rippey, muscular comic Matthew Croke, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Tushar Rahman. I hope I said that right, and I apologize if I didn't. No reason. It is just random. Special thanks to the wonderful Ken Ludwig. For information about his many comedies and musicals, go to his website, kenludwig.com. Thanks, too, to all the artists who've sat down with me over the last 500 weeks and to let me ask them impertinent questions, and to all the guys and gals in the Reduced Shakespeare Company who've let me shove a microphone in their faces to record their thoughts and fears and processes and funny stories. And finally, thanks very much to you for listening. Let's keep going for another 500, shall we? I'm Austin Titchener, 500 1500ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
It's me saying that I earlier in the podcast that I sit down and try to write Twelfth Night, because I love Twelfth Night, because it's the greatest of all the comedies,
yeah.
And it's so much in it and so deeply rich that if I can just be in touch with it, even in my mind when I'm writing my new comedy, gives me a sense of fulfillment and happiness, and being part of that tradition and part of Western civilization that way gives me a great sense of self and of calmness and of being comfortable in my own skin and being happy. That's where I get my happiness from.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.
So much less.